Who knows?
Am I getting a wind up?
Well, let's move on very quickly before the lawyers start knocking on the door.
Oh, we can edit that out. And we're back. Not an Audiophile, episode 27, season 2. Today, we're discussing with David Carrazza five hi-fi myths of the internet that must be busted, and some news. This episode of Not an Audiophile, the podcast, is sponsored by the subwoofer people, Harbottle Audio. If you're serious about subwoofers or just tired of muddy bass and bloated hype, check out Harbottle Audio. With over 800 subwoofer configurations, they solve problems from Trinov waveforming to vintage analog systems needing an actual musical subwoofer and not some hopeless air pump. No gimmicks, just pure, unadulterated bass engineered to a performance standard focused way beyond the mundane THD versus SPL. And yeah, the CEO wrote this ad. That's how inept they are at marketing and how much they care about sound. www.harbottleaudio.com. Andrew here at Not an Audiophile. Back in the room, we have David Carrazza again today to debunk or
examine
five hi-fi audio internet myths that we feel need closer examination, the word you just used, and we will we'll get to those in a second, because first we have news. So news at Not an Audiophile is that some people will notice we have improved our audio quality, and we hope that from now on it is maintained to a professional standard, as people who are audiophiles or not audiophiles would expect. There's nothing more to say about that. Sometimes on location it is hard to get great sound. The recent episode with Len and Tim Wallace is a good example of that. Their boardroom was highly reflective, and there was too many microphones, open mics, omnidirectional mics in the room, that it was a bit rowdy. Sorry about that. We're back in the studio though today. On other news, I don't know. You got any news, David? Oh, yeah, you have. You got a new job. That's right. When I say a new job, you've struck out, as you have done in previous lives of your own. You've struck out in your own business.
Correct. Yeah. It's a new venture called Impact Audio.
Impact sounds impactful.
Ooh, it's dynamite, bomb, bomb.
What do you do at Impact? Did you say Impact Audio?
Impact Audio, yeah.
Okay. Is that I have no idea what that is. What services do you offer, sir?
Well, look, if I can reduce it down to something that most people would understand, it's basically a sales agency.
Most people understand.
Well, I don't want to wax lyrical about it too much. It's basically a sales agency for small to medium-sized distributors and manufacturers and international manufacturers who wish to sell direct. And what we offer, there's three primary things.
Okay.
Brand advocacy, which means evangelizing brands and products through the Australian retail channel.
Okay. And this means that you would be going from store to store in some cities and making those stores well aware of the products that you are being requested to promote.
Most definitely. Yes. Yeah. So this kind of service is really made for small to medium manufacturers and or distributors.
Yes.
Who don't have permanent staff in every state, because there's a cost impost with that, there's a legal impost with that, and you know, things aren't getting cheaper to do business in this country. So here's an agency.
You're on the ground. You're there anyhow.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's an economy of scale where you're in the store.
Correct.
You can put different hats on.
Indeed.
At 5-minute intervals. So what's the other service that you offer other than visiting stores and offering representation?
Well, that's primarily it, but deriving from that, there's also assistance with marketing.
So even
things like devising copy for website and brochures and things like that, because you know, if you have a number of eyes casting over.
That's an important point, hey.
It is.
Because there's nothing worse, and there's been some horrible examples recently, and I think even our own propaganda until Sharon took over and started weeding the typos out that I'd created. Nothing more embarrassing than either printing or even having a website with a typographical error.
Mm.
So, yeah, multiple eyes. And then you have some experience at writing copy and and jazzing things up and making them sound exciting. So you've got that skill. And then thirdly, is there a third thing?
Well, I guess it's product training too, concomitant with the first two. It's, you know, kind of training sales staff and perhaps even end customers about the USP of the brands products.
Okay. Yep.
And the thing about the agency is it offers national reach. So you've got Australia-wide coverage for the retail channel shows, events and customer commissioning.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you get to go to hi-fi shows
absolutely.
Have all that fun as well. Well, that's so audio.
Impact audio.
Impact. Oh, I knew I'd get it backwards. But then we keep saying it again. Impact
right.
Audio.
So
what's the company again?
Impactaudio.com.au.
Okay, website. Yep. Excellent. Make sure there's no typos on that website.
I assure you.
All righty. In other news, thanks for that, David. That's great. Good luck with that. It sounds like a great idea. And judging by your secret information that you fed back to me, there's some interest already. So that's great. The other news was that we will be, and not so much David and myself, because David's so busy with his new enterprise, he couldn't come to Munich, he said. So myself and my able assistant, Sharon, will be at Munich reporting, and we will be shooting video and recording interviews with various people and new products, etc., all of that sort of thing. And as a bit of a change from how some people do it, we'll put the videos up while the show's on, which seems like a better idea in a way.
Yeah.
It's a bit of show spirit. You want to look at a video. You can't be there, but you can watch some YouTube. And then the other thing is that we, of course, always at Not an Audiophile, don't really care so much about the giant corporates who can do their own marketing. We're interested in more interesting, niche-y sort of products that show a bit of imagination and less of that corporate. I hope I'm not costing myself corporate advertisers by saying this, but you know, maybe we're interested in those the products that my eye tends to find at Munich. Where you go, oh, that's interesting. That's a nice idea. Fills a niche. Let's get some details on that. So that's what we're doing. So Not an Audiophile on our Not an Audiophile podcast YouTube channel. We'll have video during the show. So please have a look. On that note, let's move on to
the myths.
Looking for your tribe? Visit stereonet.com today. Join one of the world's largest online communities for hi-fi, home cinema, headphones, and much more. Read the latest news and product reviews, or check out the classifieds for the largest range of gear on sale. Membership is absolutely free, so visit stereonet.com and join up today. The myths, yes. So myth number one, I'll leave a pause there in case I wish to edit, which I never do. I always say that. There's never any editing. Myth number one is it's kind of one for me to rattle on about, but I'm going to, I'm going to cover it pretty quickly. It's an interesting one. So I typed into Google the following. Is the most likely cause of an old piece of hi-fi equipment not working the capacitors? Or words to that effect.
And what did Mr. Google come back with?
Well, the AI response was degenerative AI, I think it's called, or something. It responded with, absolutely, capacitors are the worst things in the world. I may be paraphrasing. But the fact is that is a common thought, myth, and it is a myth. It's just simply a myth. So old hi-fi equipment or new hi-fi equipment, whether it's CDs, amplifiers, what have you, the chances of a capacitor being the cause of your problem are actually no higher than not 1 million, but many, many other things. And I'm not going to go on about it, but I do have a list here, so in fact I will go on about it. Yes, electrolytic capacitors can be troublesome, but so are all of these other things, and I'll quickly run through them just so you've got a balanced viewpoint, because this is a myth. So the kind of things we see in the repair shop in older and newer equipment, equally as often, almost in many cases, as capacitors, are things like cracked circuit board tracks, dry joints, everyone knows that, noisy pots and switches, intermittent noisy small signal transistors, faulty in weird ways output transistors, driver transistors that have failed because they run hot, not just electrolytic caps, but polyester caps, tantalum caps turning into resistors, things like that. Resistors going high or open, regulator transistors failing, IRCs, regulator ICs failing. open circuit wires. I know it sounds bizarre, but yes, they seem to occasionally fail, either because they've been squashed or something at some point. Crimped connectors, modern amplifier problem, but they can just bit through a bit of corrosion or something, or not being correctly crimped, fail 10 years down the track and be intermittent. Internally failing sockets, switches, input switching ICs with weird faults, voltage amplifier IC problems, which, you know, because they run quite hot as well, fail somewhat prematurely, etc., etc. And so the point is, yes, electrolytic capacitors fail. I had one yesterday in a project turntable, which for people who fix project turntables will go, yeah, surprise, surprise. Now, why was that capacitor faulty? Because it was a garbage brand. In fact, it's a weird thing. It's quite good project turntable, and when it was finished, it sounded great. But they used some Rubicon electrolytics in there, David, but also Kung Fu brand, which is not so well known, and then Jackson, which is my favourite. Jackson, J-A, that's two Jackson electrolytic capacitors, J-A-X-A-O-N, and there's J-A-C-K-S-O-N. I think one brand was trying to, you know, get in on the act of the fame of the other brand. Both terrible capacitors.
You mean you didn't replace it with an Itchy Dragon brand?
And it, no, I put a Nikicon in there, which okay. is, you know, or a Panasonic or a Rubicon. They're all good. Any Japanese capacitor is pretty good. So, and that's the whole point. Brands with good caps in them generally won't fail, and that and therefore most older equipment, because it had good capacitors in it, it's very rarely the problem. I mean, it can be the problem, but it's more likely transistors. If there was a common thing, it would be small signal transistors. And on that note, myth busted. Not because I say so, but because I live it every day.
Well, isn't that interesting? Well, what, in your opinion, then, gave rise to that myth? Because in your professional work life, you've obviously saw that that's not the case.
What gave rise to it, I believe, is that in the late 90s, well, early 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, there were little short eras of a year or two where there were faulty batches of capacitors. There was a period where early surface mount electrolytics were terribly unreliable, Bose Wave radios being a great example of that, but also video cameras of the era were notorious for it. Yeah, they'd leak, ruin the circuit board, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was a later, there were later ones like the Bose Wave radio ones. They don't leak generally; they just go resistive and sort of lose their capacitance, and cause weird faults. And then there was a great example the other day, and I can't remember for the life of me what piece of gear I was working on, but it was a very good quality product and very good quality capacitors. But there were four; they were in a sub. Voltage, a sub-supply rail filtering capacity, a main filter, and they were simply being operated too close to their voltage rating. I think there was like 22, 23 volts on a 25-volt capacitor. And, of course, they're in the filtering stage. They're getting a lot of ripple on them, and if it's the wrong specified capacitor, they will get upset by that ripple within about 10 years. And so, and they were leaking, not catastrophically, didn't ruin the circuit board in this case, but there are examples where that happens. And so there are these bad examples where batches of capacitors or some brands, unfortunately for that brand, they'll have a model run where they bought a bunch of caps that were either faulty or they used them in a way that was inappropriate, maybe because the cap wasn't specified correctly, who knows. But the point is, yeah, there are examples, bad examples, but mostly. And when we talk about so-called vintage gear, it's really not a problem. Yeah, there might be a few caps. You put new coupling caps in, sure, but you don't need to change every capacitor. And you may well change the character of the amp away from what you had in mind as well. But yeah, so thanks for asking that question, David. I mean, all these myths start somehow. Mm. And our next myth is a classic example of that. So to roll straight into that, stylus cleaning. So myth number two,
yeah.
Liquid stylus cleaners will have your stylus tip breaking off, falling off, falling out, disappearing.
Oh dear.
I have thoughts on this. Do you have, I mean, what do you use to clean your styluses?
Basically Audio-Technica fluid and the Audio-Technica brush.
Is that right? The little...
Yes, the little
one here, the AT. I've got one in my hand.
Read it out.
AT, I think it's 607. Oh, man.
I've got to get better glasses or something. Yeah, there it is. AT607A. And the A might be for alcohol.
Might be too.
Because here's a thought that the internet says might be right, is that the original version of 607 may have had slightly different...
formula?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Audifon seem to be the main one that's concerned about their tips falling out. And there are examples of this. And I have seen tips missing on one or two Audifons in my lifetime. And maybe that was the cause. I don't know. But the reality is that I recently had a Lin cartridge on my own turntable that I put in the drawer because I could not get it to sound any good. So I'd cleaned it with brushes. I cleaned it with goop, which I'm not, you know, I don't hate that goop idea, although I think it's prone to contamination pretty readily, and maybe when it goes off it contaminates the tip, don't know. Long story short, I pulled this cartridge back out of the drawer, put it under the microscope and went, oh yeah, there is a build-up of like a hardened gunge. And then I remember the guy I bought the turntable off was a great lover of treating his records. You know, with some kind of spray and wipe.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes. Not spray and wipe as in the product, but you spray something on and then you clean it off. And maybe it anti-static treats, etc. So I then use the liquid cleaner under the microscope, which is kind of the way to do it, and you get most of the liquid off the brush, and I clean this hardened gunk off. Imagine. I haven't re-listened to the cartridge, I must say, to be honest. I haven't had time, but I suspect it'll sound fine now.
Yeah,
because when you saw what was built up, there's no way it could track properly.
Well, look, you know, I'm sure that's the case in some instances. But to get back to the myth, I think it's, if I can be frank, basically horseshit, because there's no way in the world that companies like Nagoka and Audio Technica would allow a formulation to dissolve or somehow damage styli in the real world. I mean, their professional reputation is dependent on that. So I've seen too many people mishandle, and I'll be polite, mishandle cartridges and styli far more than any liquid cleaner could mishandle them.
I wholeheartedly agree. And just to wrap up the whole stylus cleaning thing, I can't find any better way to clean a stylus than using that Audio Technica stuff as an example. I'm sure the Nagoka stuff is exactly the same. I think it's probably a similar formulation. I mean, you could probably make a bold statement and say Japanese cartridges use epoxy glue to hold the tip in the cantilever and therefore probably are not a problem, whereas I think Audifon might be using some kind of, you know, kindergarten glue that you can eat safely or something like that. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing over there in Scandinavia. But, you know, your answer is, you know, don't buy an Audifon if it's a problem. In reality, they make great cartridges, and I think that there's probably not a problem.
I would strongly suspect that there is not.
No, I think they could be. This is the difficult thing to work out with some manufacturers, is maybe they just don't want you to clean the stylus properly and buy a new stylus. Maybe. Who knows? Am I getting a wind up?
Well, let's move on very quickly before the lawyers start knocking on the door.
Oh, we can edit that out. Bottom line is, I've never seen it to be a problem. And the only way you're going to clean a stylus properly is a liquid cleaner. Liquid cleaners are dirt cheap. Mm-hmm. Go for it.
You know. Absolutely.
AI, by the way, says that that's a big problem. So it's almost certainly a myth.
Oh, dearie me.
So if you average out the information on the internet, which AI does, I guess, apparently it's a problem. I assure you, listener.
Okay.
Listeners. I think there's two people listening now that, it's not a problem. Let's have a quick break. We've got to pay for this podcast somehow. We're going to play an ad. Back soon. I was just talking to Jeff at Hey Now Hi-Fi about his latest installation, another Doman turntable, this time one with a Supertrack Blackbird arm and a Mutec Hayabusa cartridge. Motorcyclists everywhere are wondering how that could be. Blackbird arm, Hayabusa cartridge. Yeah. Anyhow, then he said he was going back to the store to listen to some records on the Helix 2 in-store unit. I thought, do you ever get sick of listening to records? But then maybe not, playing them back through the Fisher & Fisher speakers that are crafted from slate. Anyhow, enough discussion of Jeff's antics. Back to the show. David.
Yes.
I believe you have Myth number three, loaded and ready to...
Yes, we are ready to go with this one. And I'm sure it's a myth that a lot of our gentle listeners have come across. Basically, the myth is that when you go to a hi-fi show, you can't really have any good sound in any of the rooms, and thus you can't really evaluate the gear. Mm. What do you think about that?
Well, it's now become quite fashionable to say that.
I noticed.
The bit that annoys me is why, because it's clearly not true, right?
Agreed. I totally agree with you.
There are two issues in hi-fi shows, and neither of those is the acoustics. It's just a fact. I'm sorry. The rooms that most – we've all been there. We've had to set equipment up and try to make it sound good. You do the same thing as you do in a hotel room as you do in a customer's home.
Correct.
You optimize the scenario to get the best sound that you can.
Yep.
And sure, it's not a – acoustically corrected space, but there's a combination of there's carpet, there's drapes, there's chairs, sofas, humans, things on the wall. There's a bit of rough diffusion in our room because we manufacture diffusers. We, of course, bring our own. We get pretty good acoustic quality to the room, and then really it's up to the equipment to sound okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Some of the best sound, actually. Not some of the best sound I've heard in my life. All of the best sound that I've heard in my life, as far as the best sound, has been at hi-fi shows. That's because I've never been to the MBL dealer or the whatever dealer. I'll admit I've heard Wilson Audio sound better at hi-fi dealers than I have at shows, but I could say why I believe that's the case, but that would be unkind to a certain amplifier manufacturer, so I'll just leave it there.
Indeed.
But, I think mostly, though, best sound I've heard is at shows because it's the best gear.
Mm.
So what a kind of weird statement. What do you think the real problems at a show are, David?
I think there's a structural problem, but there's also a sociological problem with shows.
Ooh.
Let me start with this.
So more than two issues.
Simple meat and potatoes. One is in some hotels, which is invariably the venue for most hi-fi shows, the walls are tympanic. They're basically passive radiators, or resonators, I should say.
Yes.
And they're a pain in the ass.
Mm.
And I've been to heaps of shows where I'm in one room and suddenly a stray 25 hertz waveform decides to say hello from the next room.
Yeah, of course.
It is what it is. That said, very quickly, there are also rooms where you can go into and they've got solid walls and there's pretty good isolation, not all the time. But look, your point about domestic listening spaces, they are the most eye-wateringly compromised spaces on the planet. Mm. I've lost count of the amount of times, and listeners, I'm sure you've witnessed this, where some person has literally a six-figure audio system in this palatial McMansion with terrazzo tiles, parallel surfaces, mirrors on the ceiling, what have you.
Glass.
You know, maybe wrong room, but you know what I mean. But it's just like it just defies simple physics and how they manage to do this. I think you're right. I think most manufacturers, distributors, retailers who do exhibit at hotels try and make the best out of a bad thing. But if I can move very quickly onto the sociological problem,
the sociological problem is
it's a compromised listening space, not because of the room, because of the people milling in and out all the time and gas bagging and never shutting up.
Yeah, that's a I said there's two problems. Well, one is leakage of either subsonic bass or just general noise, if you like, from an adjacent room. But then there's the ambient noise in the room.
Sure.
And look, I think we've probably both been guilty, I don't think as much as many, but of talking to a client in the room or a mate briefly and quietly and being guilty doing it, as in feeling guilty, knowing that it's not helping the demo for the potential purchaser who's trying to listen to your equipment. But quite often those conversations, unfortunately, are triggered by the other person and you sort of do the secret symbol and let's go outside.
Yes.
Finger to the lips.
Yep.
You know, like, let's just take this outside.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're like, they're oblivious to it.
Well, some people aren't self-aware in their greater existence as it is anyway. So talking at 85 dB over a demo in a hi-fi room at a show,
well, yeah,
it's no problem
actually
for them.
Raising their voice get over the music. We're here for the music.
This music is interrupting our conversation.
And look, the thing with hi-fi shows is you do catch up with people that you haven't seen for maybe a year or whatever, and you've got, you know, news to share or whatever, and you're excited to chat for 5 minutes. But take it outside. And so we were both at the Sydney show the other day. A couple of observations. Sound was pretty good. A lot of rooms had great sound. I think we've mentioned in various bits of Norton Audiophile podcast, YouTube channel reporting, there's a short video that I spoke over the top of for copyright purposes, mostly to wind down the background music so YouTube didn't shut the video down for copyright reasons. Extolled the virtues of certain rooms. There were some rooms that sounded genuinely great, and there were rooms where you could get a taste that product actually in the right environment would be really, really good because it's actually surprisingly good here. So I think that's possible. I think exhibitors could already exhibitors go to a lot of trouble to get great sound, but they could just quieten down the in-room noise. The other thing, actually, and I thought it was where you were going with your psychological, mm-hmm. not profiling, but the psychological issue that I feel strongly about is the one where people are used to the sound of their own system. They go to a hi-fi show, nothing sounds any good because their brain is kind of keyed in and balanced, EQ'd internally to what they're hearing at home.
Absolutely.
So have you had an experience with that, or are you, I mean, no, you probably have yourself.
Yeah,
you?
I mean, hundreds of instances in the sense that there's people I know who are, you know, either friends or work colleagues or acquaintances, and certainly myself too, because we all have our, and it's not even predispositions, as you correctly said, it's the ear-brain mechanism having this imprint, if you will, saying, well, this is what hi-fi should sound like, or this is what music should sound like, and you go into a different room and for whatever reason it's sounding quite different to your expectation, therefore,
yeah.
Ugh, say bad.
Yeah, yeah, quite jarring. Mm. And what I would say in that scenario is stay longer in the room,
mm-hmm.
particularly if it's a nice listening space, and just mm-hmm. maybe just see whether you kind of adjust. Because if you're in a room where you've always loved that brand, you thought it was great, you've read the magazines, you've read the internet, you want to own that brand one day, you've aspired
correct.
To ownership of some amazing product, and it's like, ooh, what's going on here?
Why does it sound like that?
Yeah, just wait.
Must be the room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So just give it a bit, but then it may still be wrong because maybe it is the room. So to sum up, you can get great and spectacularly good sound at hi-fi shows. I know you can because I've done it for the last 20 years. But there's a couple of provisos, but it's a myth to say you can't get good sound at a show.
Agreed.
Can you get consistently perfect sound and the best of it out of a product? Probably not. Should be able to get a useful taste, though. I'm going to roll another ad back in a second. An Australian loudspeaker legend has been born with the stunning new VAF Research i93 Mark V, winner of StereoNet's Floor Standing Loudspeaker Product of the Year and Sound and Image Magazine's Floor Standing Speaker of the Year, $20,000 to $50,000. VAF's i93 has redefined what I thought was possible from a loudspeaker in a domestic setting, says StereoNet. VAF Research, building award-winning loudspeakers in Australia since 1978. Not an audiophile. Andrew Hutchison speaking, and David Carazza is in the room as well with yet another myth. Myth number 4. David, speak.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know whether it's a myth. It's a bone of contention. I think that's probably a better...
Yeah, this is less of a myth, I think.
It's a better way to describe it. There's a lot of people huffing and puffing and, you know, hands on hips, you know, and steam coming out of their ears going, you know, streaming is robbing musicians and it's not fair and by jingo there should be a fairer model. And they may or may not be right. What I think a lot of people don't realise is how much it costs to actually host and do streaming.
You mean like as far as the internet side of it? Whole serving, the storage and bandwidth? And
do you think a server farm might consume a few megawatts?
Megawatts, and not to mention the... storage and the bandwidth would be – bandwidth is not free.
Bandwidth isn't free, nor is security.
No.
So there's all those infrastructural elements that people seem to not think of for whatever reason, which I find odd. Look, the thing is, let's have a look at one of the big providers here, Spotify, which is probably the most pervasive and the best well-known. And the funny thing is, even though we're allegedly not an audiophile podcast, the funny thing, the ironic thing in my book is that Spotify really tops out at, what is it, 320 kbps.
Mm.
So, look, it's not terrible.
We're not audiophiles, Dave. We'll listen to anything on the Sonos system. Why did I just put that in there? I have to edit that out.
Yeah, you'd have to edit that out.
I will have to edit that out.
So getting back to Spotify, I've got some numbers here, and I'll try and make this really, really quick, but it's interesting to actually get a handle on their business model. By the way, they're like Amazon in the early days. They haven't made a profit. In fact, they're losing something like 450 million euro a year.
Holy mackerel.
Oh, yeah, it's huge.
When I say holy mackerel, I probably shouldn't have said that either. I'll edit that out. $1 billion Australian dollars.
Almost, yeah.
In a year?
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
Okay, that's very generous of them then in that case. So they're actually a very generous business. Well, they are. I mean,
they
put $1 billion into the music industry.
Yeah, that's true. And people forget this. The operational costs of Spotify are just insane. And they pay, look, they don't pay a lot per stream, per play of a track. It's 0.003 0.005 cent per stream. So, you know, that's not a lot. I totally agree.
Yeah.
And there's been kind of conjecture on the interwebs over the last couple of years saying, oh, we need it to have it at least a cent per stream, which, you know, to the average Joe and Jane in the street sounds pretty reasonable.
Yeah, yeah.
But the operational...
It adds up, right?
You think? That's a
well, it already adds up to nearly $1 million Australian a year. A billion, I should say.
It's ludicrous. Look, the thing is also, let's have a think about this. They charge roughly $10 per month for their premium service, and that's their service without ads.
Yes.
Because their revenue is derived from, you know, basically advertising and people subscribing.
Yeah.
Now, what people don't understand is that by the time Spotify actually pay the piper for all the operational costs, they give something like, what is it here? So they've got about, they keep about 30% of their revenues to themselves, and 70% gets paid out, not to the artists. See, this is another myth that people don't get. They pay to the labels or the publishers. And then the labels and the publishers then, after taking their pound of flesh, which could be advances, bloody blah, then give it to the artist.
That's the other thing. So you and I start a band. It won't be a good band, but we start one. And we somehow, because we know someone in the trade, we get a deal, right? We get a contract.
Yeah.
God knows how. Mind you, the standards are quite low at the moment, it would seem, based on a lot of new music, but that's just an old man's opinion. So we get this gig, we get this contract.
Yeah.
How do we record an album, do you think, these days? In the old days, we would have been given an advance,
like you
alluded to, and we would use that to pay for studio time and pay ourselves, you know, some money to, you know, enable purchase of, you know, weed, cocaine, whatever.
Great song.
To get through the drama, the genuinely hard work of sitting around in an air-conditioned studio and playing music. So... sounds slightly sarcastic, doesn't it? And so we do that. So does it not work like that anymore? Or?
Well, it can with the big labels. It certainly does. By the way, I've quickly got to interject.
So you've got to pay that money back.
It's a loan. What they call it, an advance. We'll advance you this, but subsequently we're going to take it out of your earnings.
Out of your income.
And, you know, the people who don't get paid, a lot of the small to medium streamed artists, I guess. I mean, you look at someone like Taylor Swift or Ed Sheeran or, you know, the big mainstream artists. I mean, they've made hundreds of millions literally hundreds of millions out of Spotify. So
they have.
Oh, absolutely. It's there in black and white. You just have a look
at. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They've okay. made serious money from Spotify.
Yeah, so I guess that's then to some degree the music business is no more messed up than it was
no,
40 years ago.
Using a different platform.
There are huge winners and mostly losers.
And mostly losers. Back yeah. in the day when, let's not even talk about vinyl, let's say CDs, when CDs were sold for approximately, I don't know, 15, 20 bucks Australian, the artist at the end of the day would be lucky to get a buck out of that.
Yeah.
And that's forever. Like you yes. sell one CD and
yeah,
you're not going to get money out of that
yes,
CD
yeah,
again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
so if
yeah.
you sold 4,000 CDs.
Yes.
You'd get maybe $4,000.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not defending streaming as a model. I'm just saying that the economic reality of streaming.
Can compare carrots with carrots rather yeah. than or apples rather with than apples, oranges. Yeah. Or I don't know how I got carrots in there. I think it's going down the path of a dangling carrot. I think the reality is. So you have a philosophical position on this?
I do. By the way, for those of you who want to do your research, Apple Music pay a little more than Spotify. I think they pay between 0.007 cents and dollars, I should say, or up to about a tenth of a cent.
Wow.
Yay. But Cubase apparently pay artists more. I think it's something like $0.043 per stream US. Now, the thing is, these service providers, well, certainly not Apple, because Apple, it's almost a hobby for Apple. They just make so much money elsewhere.
Mm.
Look, Spotify, they've got to try and keep their shareholders happy, the labels happy, the artists happy, and the consumers happy. People say, well, pay, you know, they should pay the artists more. Well, great. Do you want your subscription to go to $20 or $30 a month? Because that's the only way they're going to bloody do it.
Well, it absolutely would.
And
of
so
course,
then people,
it's the only way they can
but,
do
but,
it.
You know, it's
on the basis that they're losing a billion
well, yeah,
Aussie shekels
well,
a year.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, in an absolute moral sense, yeah, they should pay them more, but the business model doesn't support it. Ultimately, the user pays.
Yeah.
If you want to kind of be, you know, kind of virtue signaling and say the artists need more money, well, get prepared, get your money out and pay more for the service. It's the only way it's going to work.
I've got a couple of observations about this. One is that some commentators say, oh, you should, you know, when you're at the concert, you should buy the album that they have, that they currently are selling with their merch and so forth, or buy some merch. Well, my thought is, yeah, I could do that, and I've done that. But I also just bought the concert ticket, and they're not cheap, not really. In fact, if you get a plumber out, this is just my take on it, you get a plumber out, that might vary between $150 and $300. They'll be there for an hour or so. And you get rid of your water leak or your non-functioning, non-draining drain. It's a beautiful job. Fairly unpleasant. When I say beautiful, I mean very sarcastically, a quite unpleasant task for the plumber to perform. On the other hand, and it's just the one plumber and the one customer, but what we do is with a concert is we assemble a whole bunch of customers who get there under their own steam into one place, and then the musicians turn up and get to charge each and every person the same $150 to $300 mm-hmm. that the plumber charges, but they only do the tap repair once. You've got 2,000 people sitting in a theatre. You charge every single one of those. Now, this is a terrible analogy and people will be fuming.
No, it's actually not, but go ahead.
But let's pretend the musician is also a plumber in his day job. He's laughing. He's like, this is hilarious. I'm fixing one tap. And getting and but for 2,000 customers all at one time.
If look, that's lovely, and
there's lots of overhead. You've got to hire the theatre; yeah, it's got to be promoted, etc.
We get that. Yeah. But you know, that's a luxury that only mid to high tier artists have.
Oh yeah, you've got to be an actual talent.
Well, this is
more
it.
Or less,
so
yeah.
You know, my argument is, you know, for everyone kind of jumping up and down, going, oh, they only get, you know, a thousandth of a cent. Well, yeah, and that's sad. And we'd all love musicians to get paid, you know, better, I suppose. But, you know, it's the problem is this is just it's a litmus test. It's a free market.
It's a free market.
If someone doesn't get played, if someone doesn't get a lot of streams, it's because people don't like their music. I'm not saying the music is intrinsically bad or good.
No.
It's just that it doesn't appeal.
It comes back to marketing. It's no different to anyone starting a coffee shop and doing a piss poor job of either making the coffee or marketing.
Yep.
You failed. Not because of any fault of the government or anyone else. Your coffee was bad and you didn't tell anyone you existed. Hey, not an audiophile. I'll be reporting from the Munich High End Show, which is on very shortly, of course. Putting videos up almost immediately, recording interviews, etc. And the videos will be available at Not an Audiophile Podcast, the YouTube channel. And we're sort of, I guess, as we try to do, try to cover some of the other things that some of the mainstream media that are attending don't necessarily cover. We're looking for, you know, with our educated eye, some interesting products that other people may miss. So, yeah, please check in during the show. And one more thing before we go back to, or not back to, but start Myth 5 on Myth 4, is that David and I, just talking in the break, that very long break where that ad played, was that we love music. I mean, it's why we're here. It's why we're doing this podcast. It's why we've always been involved with the audio business. It's a love of music, and musicians are great people. We'd all love them to, you know, to get paid more.
Absolutely.
But there is, you just have to kind of, it's not all, you know, musicians don't always do that badly. They do what they want to do, the same as you and I effectively both do what we want to do, and we are doing it right now, but we're not getting paid for it, right? So it's one of those things. You got to... The other thing is the bad old days. When I was an apprentice learning how to fix electronic equipment, I got paid $77.50 a week, and a record was about $15.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's just look at that. As a 16-year-old, if I wanted to buy a record to listen to music, I was going to spend about a fifth of my wage. A fifth of a 16-year-old's wage now is probably closer to $200 or certainly $150. And I'll say $100 for those that are really, you know, doing it hard working at KFC. So how much does a record cost now? Actually, about $100. But guess what? You don't need to buy the record.
No, that's it.
That's 6 months' worth of subscription to the aforementioned Spotify.
The thing is...
And you can listen to every album in the world.
Literally, and that's it. For the price of 3 coffees a month, you get unbridled access to virtually everything that's been recorded. Now, this has never happened in the history
of
mankind. It's total
bargain. Ever.
It's a total bargain.
There's never been ever since, like, you used to be able to get free dinosaurs with every whatever, you know, if you go far back enough back in time. I mean, they'd probably eat you, right? But the point is, but no, there's never been a better bargain.
I agree.
Nothing like it. It was as if cars ran on air. All right, myth number 5. This is the myth that we've been wanting to get to. Now, David, you and I have both worked in retail, wholesale, and manufacturing in the audio business. Mm-hmm. We have some knowledge of how these things happen. And so it is with some experience that we put forward the following case that... Although there's two ways to present this case. So the gist of it is that buying equipment direct from the manufacturer is cheaper, less expensive than buying it through traditional retail channels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is outwardly, probably at a glance, kind of true, depending how you perform your accounting.
Correct.
But the myth part of this that's put forward by certain other mouthpieces in the audio business, people who I quite like and I find them entertaining, but they have said that it can be dramatically cheaper to do this, like half the price or a third of the price to buy direct from the manufacturer than through a retail store.
Yep.
Now, I'll let you speak on this and I'll just chip in now and then, but... We both know this is horseshit, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And don't forget there's nuances within this argument as well, because for the sake of brevity and simplicity, you could conceive of buying direct in two different camps. The first camp is, gee whiz, that doesn't cost much and I just pay via PayPal. It comes from southern China and tickety-boo, it's at the doorstep a couple of weeks later and it's mine.
Yep.
That's great. And yes, things like that will be cheaper.
Yeah,
but
of course.
There'll be virtually zero support, no hand-holding, nothing that you get, say, in a retail chain, of course. But that's implicit with the purchase, one would think. The other direct way of buying is if you buy through an established manufacturer that's even located in the same country, and there's a few manufacturers doing this globally now and will continue to do this, selling direct to the customer. There's a lot more hand-holding, maybe not to the point of, say, a retail operation.
Yeah.
But those first two things I mentioned are two different things.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a complex subject, and we're not going to get bogged down and turn it into a half-an-hour conversation, although it's worthy of many hours. But I think the point we want to make is two key things. Let's talk about premium quality products. When I say premium, I mean entry-level Rotel amplifiers and above. We're not talking about Sonos or some cheapy active speaker from China for $200 a pair. We're not talking about that. Of course, that's a different kind of thing.
Yep.
And as someone who sees inside those products occasionally, oh my God, you get exactly what you pay for, by
the way. Of course
you do. If it works, that's a bonus.
You always do.
So wind back. So there's, from an accounting point of view, you could say, well, I spent less, so I've saved money. But no, because there's things that you need from your audio equipment. You might need, like you said, a certain amount of hand-holding to get it performing correctly.
Correct.
You may have a faulty one, and your time may be worth something, and you don't wish to deal with the whole freighting, packing it and freighting it back to God knows where to get it replaced, maybe. And then they go, oh, well, you know, it's not under warranty because blah, blah, blah. And you can't speak to anyone. I mean, everyone complains about the dramas of dealing with Telstra. But the reality is that, you know, this is you. That's where you're going with buying something online in many cases. Not in all. The joy, though, of having a problem and having had some hi-fi salesman hand you the product and say, if you have a problem, you let me know.
Yep.
You can go, well, I'm going to let him know because I'm definitely having a problem.
Exactly.
And so I'm not sure if you can put a price on that, but it certainly has a value.
Look, it's got an extreme value, and unfortunately it doesn't ever show up on a product spec sheet, and certainly not on a spreadsheet. And people so conveniently forget that most retailers that's here in Australia and certainly overseas as well, the vast majority of them go so far beyond what they need to do. And the vast majority I've spoken to definitely have the customer's interest at heart, because if they don't, their business is going to go down the toilet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Their business is – I mean, all businesses that sell products are customer-centric, I guess, but there's this weird thing where do you really think that Apple care about people because you – are used to iPhones, you need another one, you just have to buy another one. You know, if the customer experience is mediocre, it's a bit like I said with Telstra, you've just got to, you need them. You can't live without them. You kind of put up with it.
Yep.
What about things like, you know, the implication from those that put forward that buying direct is cheaper is that it's just the manufacturer and you save money because you're not replicating the same distribution, warehousing, marketing, etc. I find that a little odd, because one thing I read on the internet as recently as right now, this morning, was that you buy direct and you save the cost of the retail store. How the hell is that? Because, well, you've given away the opportunity to have a retail experience. So, yes, you save that because you don't get to go in and listen to alternative products in the same price category or what have you.
Which may have suited you better.
Yeah, you will never know.
You'll never know.
No.
Until you get it at home, and then it's too late.
So you've given that up. Well, of course, that has a value. You've given up that interesting, you know, you've given it up, you save money, of course.
It is really weird how people's thought processes function when they're purchasing something, because we're in an age now, and it's certainly not exclusive to YouTube and the web as we know it now, but certainly back in the days of flat dead trees with ink on them, it was certainly the case. A reviewer would come out, people would throw their hands up in the air, have an orgasm and rush out and buy the new thing and then bring it home and go, oh shit, it's not really what I want. In some cases it certainly was, but you can't buy on reputation alone. The golden thing, and I know not everyone on the planet can do this, but you've really got to listen to the thing, and that's why retailers exist.
Yeah,
I don't care how good a review is, because I've read reviews and I've heard things in real life and I'm thinking, how does this concur with what you've just written here?
There's that, and there's like everyone's got their own idea of the sound they want.
Well, precisely.
So the reviewer has an opinion, and it's probably a well-educated opinion in the sense that they've listened to lots of stuff, but
it serves their listening biases.
Still their opinion, that's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so there's that. So you've given up the retail experience, you save some money, but then people say, well, I'm happy to give up the marketing experience. I don't want this thing to be marketed to me. Well, it still will be, because just that instead of the manufacturer sharing the marketing responsibility with a distributor and a retailer, it's only going to come from the manufacturer. So they're either going to do three times as much of that, or they're not going to reach the same audience. So it's simple mathematics.
I wonder which of those two happens in the real world.
Well, I mean, what do you think? I mean, have you been involved with manufacturers
absolutely.
That have sold direct
I think most manufacturers who sell direct don't do excessive marketing. They just, I mean, and this is not just in hi-fi. I don't want to get too far away from this, but they'll chuck it on a platform like Amazon and hey-ho, let her rip.
Yeah. I guess there's that. The other, this is just an observation, and it's just an observation. I'm not an economist, and I'm not a marketer, and I'm not a qualified businessman. But businesses that have decided to go direct in the hi-fi world have never hung around in my memory, unless you can think of one. I mean, I can think of a great example of the opposite, and we mentioned it in a previous podcast, the one where we talked about Bose taking over Macintosh.
Correct.
And that is that Bose had an amazing business when they sold through retail and normal distribution channels. They were the best known hi-fi brand in the world either before or after Sony in the 80s.
Yep.
You could put a dust coat on with pens in your pocket and stand in the street with a clipboard and ask random people as they walk past, name a hi-fi speaker brand, and every single 9 out of 10 at least would say Bose.
Yep.
If you did that same thing today, I don't know what they would say. They would say, I don't even know what hi-fi is, probably. But so that's where they were. For those that weren't around and don't care, well, don't care by all means, but the point is that was a fact. And then Bose started reeling in the distribution thing. They wound down the global distribution model.
Yep, they sure did.
They started doing a lot of selling direct. And then they ended up with a business that sold a few scabby-looking active speakers and some quite good aviation headsets and a few noise-cancelling headphones, and that's what they turned that business into, to the point where I had to buy a Macintosh to get some distribution back again. So, I mean, is that what happened? But certainly they collapsed the business in on itself by trying to sell it direct, I think.
It's my opinion, but in my experience, to get maximum reach, you have to have retail channels. Otherwise, this mythology of things costing you not much money, to build the marketing reach, if you say sacrifice a retail channel, you're going to do a Bose and go, oh, I'm going to do it all direct. But to get the same reach as a retail channel has, boy, are you going to spend some money on bloody marketing.
You are, and then they would say, well, we have the money to do it, but they haven't looked at the situation carefully enough, in my opinion, because the only way you can cheaply have a customer interaction with end users, terrible, terrible term, but, you know, accurate in this case, the person who ultimately buys the product and takes it home, is to call Mumbai and have a call centre. Because if you've got people with good knowledge of hi-fi, i.e. the person who works in a hi-fi store normally, talking on a phone and offering advice to people because you're selling direct. Well, you still got to employ them, and you're back to you've saved some real estate maybe, because you can shove them in a corner down near the toilets or something, and give them a mobile phone, a headset, and say, there you go. Customers might ring in. I don't know, but it's once again, the point of what we're saying is compare like with like, folks. You will save money. you will not get the same service in any way, I feel.
I agree.
So it's a myth. It's not cheaper.
I agree.
Depending how you do your accounting. On that note, we're off. Thank you, David. It's been great, I think. And
thank
it's
you.
It's most important that we think it's great.
It's sensational.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. And, yeah, like and subscribe would be much appreciated. If you could make that happen, that would help us along and would give us the fame that we're all searching for. All right, I'll see everybody at Munich. Bye.